Thank you very much, Kath, and all of you for your prayers. This is a talk about one of the wonderful moments in the Bible. This is the moment when the text begins to show us who we are. I will be speaking about the remarkable and profound idea made in the image of God. In the image of God. This is the way Genesis chapter 1 introduces the human race. I will be inviting us all to think about what it means. That is the main point of this sermon. Do you think you could just turn me down a tad? I feel I'm coming in from everywhere at the moment. Okay, thanks. I will also talk about some of the confusions or mistakes that people sometimes have about this. In the words of Genesis, there are some terms that can get misinterpreted. Words such as subdue and have dominion. So I will also explain what these are about. But I don't want to keep you in suspense. So let me say right away, this idea of subdue and dominion, what is it about? In brief, it is that we are meant to order the world and bring it to fruition, and we are meant to do this in a creative way with wisdom and care. That is what I will come to later in the talk. But to begin with, let's consider how the Bible starts. The Bible begins by showing us something of who God is. I pray, Eternal Father, that I may say this right and that we may understand it right. The Eternal One, our root and caller, is one who creates, one who speaks calmly and who has no rivals, and one who affirms what he has created. God is also one who invites the created creatures to live and increase according to their various natures. Go and live, he says, in effect, to the animals on land and sea. Fill the earth, explore, have young, do your thing. This shows us our true parent as liberating, not controlling. God inviting the living things of the world to experience their life and fulfill their potential. That is the first main point of Genesis chapter 1. It shows some truths about the character of God. At the same time, the text shows us something of the nature of the created world. The world is not divine, but it is treasured and affirmed. The world is orderly, it is dependable, it is suited to its function. One of the important ideas is contained in the phrase, "And God saw that it was good." This phrase occurs 7 times. Or if you like, it occurs 6 times, and then the 7th time it says, "God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good." Now, I would like to remind you, James has already said something about this, and I will offer you another reflection on it. The word good here, this word good is a Hebrew word tov. The sense of it in Genesis is a bit like a craftsman who says that the thing he has made is good because it works. It does what it is meant to do. The world was made good in the sense of sound. It is suited to its purpose. Now, I'll give you an example. When this church building around us was built not so long ago, the walls and the floor and the roof all had to be provided. And also, we needed some interior features and some practical tools. For example, we needed this stage that I am standing on, and we needed lights and chairs, and we needed a convenient way to move the chairs around. So people like Duncan Corey and Yuri Eisinger and others got to work and made what was needed. Here is the chair trolley that Yuri made. Shall we see if it is any good? Okay, that seems to work all right. So when Yuri had finished making the chair trolley, he had a look at it, and behold, it was very good. So you see, the book of Genesis is saying that the natural world is a sound piece of workmanship, one which can be relied on and will do what it's meant to do. Note, though, the text does not say that the natural world is easy. It does not say that God created a kind of harmless paradise with no risk, no pain, no death, no predators, no winter, no difficulties for people living in it, and no work for them to do. On the contrary, the text says that the world will require a certain amount of marshalling. It says the world is going to need us to take it in hand and train it. I will explain this aspect in more detail in a moment, but for now I just want us all to understand that the world described in Genesis is the real world, the one we live in. It is a sound world, but it is not an easy one. Now let's come to the verses that we are studying today. This is in the New Revised Standard Version. I'll just read them through again and give us another chance to just reflect on them. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image." That word humankind, by the way, sometimes translated man. It's not a wrong translation, but it's the sense of the word in the original language was to embrace the whole of the human community. It had that sense. So that's why I like this word humankind. "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the wild animals of the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." Now, the second half of this part of the verse I'm going to skip for now. This is the further thoughts, because we're going to focus on what I've just read. Now, before I do that, I want to talk a bit about the 6 days. This is because in order that I can explain what I think the verse we're talking about today is, I need to sort of reflect a little bit on the whole of the background of the passage it's in. So notice I say 6 rather than 7 days, because in the text, the seventh day is a day of rest. And interestingly, no evening is mentioned for the seventh day. The text finishes, "So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all the work that he had done in creation." The impression that I get, and I have to say this is an impression, is that we should not read the evening and morning refrain literally, but metaphorically. I admit, as I say, this is only an impression, but note also, note this, there's nothing wrong with forming this impression. Metaphor is a perfectly good way of conveying truth, and metaphor is widely used in the Bible. Having said that, I do think that Genesis chapter 1 teaches an evolutionary creation. That is, the Bible says the world came to its present state by development over time. But I don't think there's an easy way to translate the creation days directly into periods of ordinary time. It's better to regard them as a sort of literary device which does a good job of capturing the big idea of an orderly progression. We can read them as God announcing the big picture, or the main lines of the story, and then the realization of the story takes place gradually. If you look at Christian thinking throughout the last 2,000 years, then what I've just said is a fairly standard view. For example, it was expressed by St. Augustine in the 4th century. However, I admit this is not intellectually easy, so if you're puzzled by it, I would say, don't worry, it's puzzling to all of us. If we try to understand the origins of the universe in full, then we will not be able to. And that is perfectly okay, as long as we do our best to understand what we can. The reason why it's okay to not completely understand the interpretation of the creation days in Genesis is because it involves the difference between time and eternity. The difference between time and eternity is sufficiently mind-bending that it is beyond our complete understanding. But I'll offer you this little thought. It is a mistake to regard the creation of the universe as something that happened wholly in the past. And I say this because the universe is a sort of story, and its creation involves the creation of time itself. In this picture, I showed you a writer, a composer, and a film director. Now, these people, in their acts of creation, they don't just write the opening words, or the first few notes, or the first few frames of the film. They have to create not just one moment of time, but the whole of the time in which the action takes place. Here is a picture that Chris showed last week. It's a diagram that gives an overview of the story of life on Earth. It sort of shows the billions of years progressing up through that spiral. Now, it's wrong to think that God's creative action only took place at the start, as it were, at one little dot in the bottom of that picture. That's not the right idea. Rather, God's creative act is like a support that extends throughout space and time. It holds out a pattern for the whole development of the universe, and the universe moves into and fills out this pattern. So this is not, we don't look for God's creativity primarily in individual pinpricks here and there, but rather in the whole sweep of the history of the universe. Now let's come back to the sixth day and the phrase, the image of God. We should think about this in the context of the creation narrative. On the first day, we have light. Light could be a symbol for God, couldn't it? Is light the image of God then? No. What about the second day? The air, the wind, and the life-giving water, these also are things that can serve as symbols for God. Is that the very image of God then, a sort of impersonal wind or force? No. How about the third day? The third day shows us the earth and the plants begin to grow. Is this the image of God then? Mother Earth, life-giving, supporting, nurturing. Or what about the fourth day, the sun, moon, and stars? Surely the sun, that's the very image of God, isn't it? The great sustainer of life on earth, unapproachable light, source of power, life-giving energy. Is that the image of God? No, says the writer of Genesis. That's just a lamp, a useful thing, but not divine, and not God's image either. You see, all these ways are ways that people commonly think of God. People are so fixated on the idea of God as powerful that they think of images like this, vast and full of strength. Many of our songs have that sort of focus. Our God is so big, so strong, and so mighty, there's nothing that he cannot do. This is not completely wrong, but it is not the heart of what God is about. When the Holy Spirit inspired the writers of the Bible all those years ago, he inspired them to say something different. Not so, they declare. Power and strength are not what is central in God. Power and strength may be true of God, but they are not the heart of the matter. Those qualities do not display God's image and likeness. What makes something God-like is not the ability to exert power, but the ability to empathize, to have friendship and compassion, and to love, and to direct things wisely. What makes something God-like includes, even in the end, the ability to suffer. Notice also that the text mentions male and female together as the image of God. There you have the basis of the equality of the sexes. There's a lot more to ponder here, but I will not talk about this aspect today, because it will be the subject of another sermon. So far, I pointed out that the phrase, the image of God, tells us about both ourselves and God at the same time. It hints at the idea of a connection between the ultimate root and source of all things and a community of fragile but compassionate decision makers, a community such as the human race. It is in such a community that the deepest root of the universe comes to be expressed. This is because the root of the universe is not a chaotic tumbling of atoms in the void, the root of the universe is love. And the phrase, the image of God, also refers to the role that humans are meant to play. In the ancient Near East, the phrase image and likeness would often be referred to a statue of someone. When a king or local ruler wanted to make it clear who was in charge, he, and it usually was a he, would have statues of himself set up throughout his territory. The statues stood there as a reminder. When anyone looked at the statue, it told them who's in charge around here. We have preserved an echo of this when we put the image of the Queen on our stamps and banknotes. But now think a little about this. The statue itself is not in charge. No, the statue is the image of the one who is in charge. The same applies to us. We are not the rulers of the world. We are the statues. But we show who the ruler really is. Of course, we do more than just stand there like a stone statue. We move around and take decisions and so on. The point is, the decisions we take are meant to be like the decisions God would take. We are meant to be going about his business. And his business is extremely creative. Extremely creative. Really extraordinarily creative. And liberating. And wishing great goodness on his world. This is what is set out in the account of the 6 days. So we are meant to do more of the same. Earlier in the service, I saw little Vedis leaping off the chair at the word higher, like this. Now there was the image of God being revealed in this little way in one of our youngsters. Well, think about this. Are you one of the peacemakers when there is tension in your place of work? Are you one whose instinct is to try to hear what the trouble is and try to find people a helpful route towards peace? Well, if you are, you are one of the children of God. Or what if you are made to do something which really, in fairness, someone else ought to do, but you do it willingly? Well, then you're being a child of God. Or are you in grief? Are you grieving because of a loss or someone close to you who has gone or is in deep trouble? Well, be happy. You should be grieving. And that grief shows you something about your heart. It says your heart is somewhat like God's heart. And the comfort you can draw is such hearts can be comforted. Or are you hungry for justice in the wider world? Well, great. That's the image of God in you once again. And that hunger will be fulfilled eventually. Now let's come to some more aspects of our role. What about this word dominion? The text says the human race is to have dominion over the fish and the birds and the other living things. This is the Hebrew word rudder, and it is a kingly sort of word. So as long as we don't get ideas above our station, it is saying that the human race has a certain right to decide what goes on in the world. We can, for example, manage the elephant population, but that does not mean killing all the elephants. We can stop wild animals wandering into our houses, but that does not mean we claim the right to completely destroy their natural habitat. The idea of a kingly rule is expressed quite well in Psalm 72. This psalm is an extended prayer for the king of Israel. And in verse 8 it says, "May he," that's the king of Israel, "may he have dominion from sea to sea." And it's that same word, rudder. Then the psalm goes on to say what sort of thing the psalmist has in mind. In verses 12 to 14, he says, "He delivers the needy when they call, the poor and those who have no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight." So you see, when the Hebrew Bible writes about the concept "have dominion," it doesn't mean what a lot of other people think it means. It means a very compassionate and caring sort of king. But the point is, we do have that sort of role, and we mustn't abdicate our role. We mustn't become fatalist and just allow whatever goes on in the world to happen. We have to play our part and make it a godly part, creative and wise. Now, I have to admit, I'm keeping an eye on the time, but I've lost track of the time. Can someone help me where I am? I know what time it is, but I don't know when I started. Chris, wave at me when I really need to stop, when there's 5 minutes in your opinion. All right, just give me a, I can handle that.
I'll wave in 8 minutes.
Yeah. Thanks. Now, I'm talking about the idea that we mustn't abdicate our role. You know, we are actually in charge under God. I mean, I've emphasized God is the true ruler. But we mustn't just pretend, oh, actually, we mustn't be proud, you know, back away in our sort of humility. That's not a quite an appropriate use of the word humility. That's not quite what we should be doing. And indeed, one of the dangers of religion generally in the world is that it does, in some manifestations, encourage a more fatalist start when people begin to be very passive and fatalist. I had to add, perhaps, one of the errors that Christians can be prone to is to become overactive and hasty, rushing in without enough consideration and making matters worse. However, on balance, I think the more active stance that has been adopted by followers of Jesus has overall proved to be positive. Christian impulses have often been the driving force between really great reforms, such as the rise of universal education, literacy, healthcare, democracy, and other such things. Now let's look at another word that sometimes bothers people reading Genesis. In verse 28 it says, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it." Now this word, subdue, is a Hebrew word, kabash, and it does mean subdue. Elsewhere, it's often used in the context of a conflict, and in that context it means to win the conflict and subdue the enemy by forcing them into obedience. It means to take charge. Now, our relation to the rest of the natural world is not exactly like a conflict or a war. So the natural world is not an enemy that's going to oppose us. But the account is saying, I think, that the natural world is not going to be altogether easy, and we are going to have to take charge of it. In my thinking about this week, I found an image that someone else suggested, and I found, yes, that makes sense to me. I'm not going to offer it to you. The idea of subdue the earth could be like what we have to do when we learn a musical instrument. To subdue the earth means to master the earth, to exercise mastery over it, like the way a violinist has to master the violin. Now, let me say two remarks on this. The first is a negative remark, saying what it doesn't mean, and then the second is a positive remark, saying what it does mean. So here's the first remark, the negative one. Sometime in the 20th century, someone wrote an academic thesis in which they accused the Christian worldview of taking a domineering stance towards nature and consequently being the root cause of the environmental crisis. This thesis was based on this verse from Genesis. The idea is that Christians proudly and short-sightedly gave themselves the right to do whatever they liked to the planet, and this had terribly destructive effects. Now, this claim has been widely circulated in the non-Christian world because it seems to be intellectually serious. You see, it is not just a claim about people may have behaved. It's a claim about what sort of behavior a Christian or theistic worldview might encourage. Now, I have thought a good deal about this, and my conclusion is that this academic thesis or accusation does not stand up to intellectual scrutiny. It isn't true, because it misconstrues the text of Genesis, and also it treats Christian history in a very imbalanced way. Some versions of Christian belief do treat the planet with contempt, but most do not. Most are, in fact, very thoughtful and positive in the way they reflect upon the natural world. So my overall conclusion is that this supposedly scholarly contribution is in fact little more than a malign and ill-considered attack on Christian discipleship. But I'm mentioning it here today because some of you might come up against it when talking to your friends and colleagues. So now let's think about what the mastering the world is really about. I think it has two big picture components, two sort of big overall things. First, we are meant to supervise as best we can based on our current understanding of the world. And second, we are meant to try to understand the world better and thus help it to realize its full potential. First then, supervising. This includes farming, conservation, medical care, all kinds of artistic creativity and good governance. And secondly, understanding the world. Well, this is broadly speaking what we call science. Both of these aspects are difficult and hard to master, but both are also thrilling and fulfilling. In particular, science is one of the most important ways in which we love God with our whole heart and mind and our neighbour as ourselves. I will now add a little personal remark. I hate it when people say, Christians say this and scientists say that. I hate this because plenty of scientists are Christian. And furthermore, the whole practice of science is a thoroughly Christian thing to do. There is not one group over here who are the Christians and another group over there who are the scientists. Rather, all followers of Jesus ought to be champions of science because science is an honourable and praiseworthy activity. And in fact, it is a central component of following God as a community. I say as a community because not all of us are going to be the individual professional scientists, but we must include that in what we understand the kingdom of God to be about. And this is partly how we are God's children. It is scientific understanding that has been a crucial factor in enabling us to feed the hungry and heal the sick and clothe the naked and give to people a creative role to play. Just one example of this. I understand that the government of India, sort of in the 60s, I think it was, put in a concerted effort to develop a better understanding of crops, rice yields, and things like this, because they saw that that would be needed to feed the population. So the reason people don't go hungry so much in India now is partly owing to that sort of activity. See, our prayer and our scientific efforts must be done together. It's no good having one without the other. In our time, of course, science is going to be crucial to enabling us to learn how to take better care of the planet. It's not the only ingredient. The biggest ingredient is, in fact, the human will. You know, that's the really crucial element in the environmental crisis. But scientific understanding has a role to play. And also, let me return to good governance, the way we manage the decision-making process. This includes things like an independent judicial system, a free press, secular democratic government, and high standards of integrity in public life. Now, I use the word secular there in the meaning it originally had when it was developed as part of the Christian understanding of the way things should go. It's just saying that when we have our joint decision-making, we need to be free to exchange ideas and listen to everyone. It doesn't mean what it's now come to mean about this idea that there is no role even for God in our thinking. So anyway, the idea is that I'm happy that the Houses of Parliament should be a reasonably free setting in which people could just exchange their thoughts about how governance should be done better without bringing in explicitly people's commitment to God at sort of every other sentence. They need to just be free to speak. Anyway, this is perhaps too big a subject and I should stop and we'll talk about that another time. Okay, so I have almost finished. Good, says Chris. But there is another phrase that I need to say little on, and that's the way in which the image of God points to the idea of the tremendous value of human life. Now, I sort of alluded to this a little bit when I talked a bit about what our human life is like. But let me say, throughout the history of the world, there have been attempts to say that some humans are better than others, in the sense of more valuable and more worthy of having life. Such attitudes are at the root of war, genocide, slavery, and a whole heap of other horrible things. So what we must champion in Jesus' name is that there is one equal human race, all showing God's image and likeness, and no one has the right to say that another's life is not worth living or has no right to exist. This brings us up some very difficult dilemmas. There are dilemmas, nevertheless, around subjects such as abortion and right to life and right to take leave of life. I don't have time to talk about these today, but I will say this, that to be a follower of Jesus does not mean treating any of these issues in a simplistic way. One who follows Jesus is one who brings willingness to listen hard, think carefully, and share burdens. To follow Jesus means to have a high value of the worth of every person, and it also means to understand with empathy, intelligence, and practical wisdom the very difficult situations that people face. I will finish now by summarizing. I'll do it by reading a list of 9 statements. You won't be able to remember all of these, but I will encourage you just to pick one or two and mull on those. So I'll just read them through. First, Genesis chapter 1 is a perfectly wonderful and wise part of the Bible, and we should be proud of it. 2. That does not mean taking it literally. It means taking it thoughtfully and intelligently. 3. The heart of God's nature is chiefly shown not in God's power, but in God's creativity and compassion. 4. We are meant to mirror that same creativity and compassion. 5. Our role in the context of life on earth is to understand and govern with sympathy and master the world like a musician so that we can make it produce beautiful new things. 6. The world is basically sound, and this is why science works. 7. Science, technology, artistic creativity, and good governance are ways in which we correctly exercise our stewardship. 8. We must regard all human life as having great value and reject attempts to make distinctions of value based on things like race, religion, gender, sexuality, and age. However, this fact does not on its own resolve the genuine moral dilemmas that arise around beginning and end of life issues. Rather, it feeds into the discussion of such issues. There we are. Now, I've made us work hard. I want to finish on a slightly gentler note. So I have here just a little sort of a gloss on some of these thoughts, which I found on the web. I thought it was sort of friendly. So here's a sort of a thought. This is God speaking in the words of Genesis, but just slightly interpreted. Be fruitful and have children, filling the earth with your life, so that you can have power to fight against everything in it that leads to death. Rule with care and fairness over the natural world, over the myriads of my beautiful creatures, from tropical fish to soaring eagles to dogs and cats, every creature that is part of this living world. Now, I will finish there, but if you will allow me, I'd like to suggest that we now have just a moment of silence, 20 seconds, and we can just have some thinking time. Okay, I will tell you when 20 seconds have gone by.